Good morning. Thank you for finding your seats. And I see some family members that have come into town, and it's so good to see everybody. And because some of you are old regulars in terms of coming to visit, and that feels really good. You know, I don't know how you felt the day after Thanksgiving, but Christmas kind of comes and abruptly introduces itself the minute after that turkey day is over. I know that you know what I mean. But not everybody is a fan of this kind of Christmas. And it depends on, though, what you think of when we say Christmas, what we mean by that. C.S. Lewis was not a fan of Christmas in terms of all the commercial racket. Of course, we know him to be a believer who would always celebrate the birth of Christ. But when it came to this commercial racket, I was curious as to what he said about that. He says it gives, on the whole, much more pain than pleasure. Long before December 25th, everyone is worn out. Physically worn out by weeks of daily struggle in overcrowded shops. Mentally worn out by the effort to remember all the right recipients and to think out suitable gifts for them. Then he goes on to say, we are told that the whole dreary business must go on because it's good for trade. It is, in fact, merely one annual symptom of that lunatic condition of our country and indeed of the world, in which everyone lives by persuading everyone else to buy things. And he says, I don't know the way out. I think there are times when we don't feel like there's a way out of the craziness, because Christmas comes to us like an assault after Thanksgiving. But I'm not sure we're supposed to find a way out as much as we are to find a way through it. I think we're not so much wanting to be rescued as we need to learn how to move through this season and retain our identity as God's people. In contradiction to all of this Christmas frenzy, Matthew gives us God's view of this season, and I love this. In the land, this is coming from Matthew 4. In the land of Zebulun and of Naphtali beside the sea, and beyond the Jordan River, in Galilee, where so many Gentiles live, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who lived in the land where death casts its shadow, a light has shined. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who lived in the land where death casts its shadow, a light has shined. I think that's God's view of this season. So my personal longing in all of this is that I would be able to consider the darkness around me this season. Sometimes that darkness is inside myself, and sometimes it's in other people. Sometimes it's in our staff. Sometimes it's in the people I play with. Sometimes it's the people I live beside. But I want to become more aware of that darkness. And when I say darkness, I'm talking about people who live discouraged or they're lonely. Maybe they're feeling defeated or overwhelmed, or they're caught in something that they just can't seem to get out of. Maybe they're grieving for someone that they have lost this past 12 months. So I'd like to consider that darkness, and I'd also like to consider the little light that God has given me that I carry around inside of me. I'd like to lay aside my pettiness and my unforgiveness and my Scrooge-like cynicism and my greed and my fear, and I'd like to change someone's day. I'm not even talking about their life, maybe their hour, just by something I would say or do. I'd like to plant a seed of hope. I have a picture that I may not have a torch of a light inside of me, but I know I at least have a birthday candle, you know, one of those little things. And that's all it takes in darkness, is one small light. I'd like to be transformed by the season. And I'm thinking that if I feel this way, you probably are feeling this way too. So I'd like to consider how we can do that this morning. It just takes baby steps. We're not going to get there all in one step. But if we were to take baby steps every day, bringing that light into people's darkness, we would find a way through the dark times. I want to take this passage of Matthew and go back to where it originated, which was in Isaiah 9. And the context there is also a time of darkness. Isaiah had delivered this message at a time when Israel was experiencing a siege from an outside enemy. But I need to put it in context so that we'll get a picture of what's going on. We all know about Abraham and then Moses, who led the people out of Egypt, and how Moses gave the people a covenant about how to treat one another and how to relate to Yahweh. David comes about 700 years later, and you know about King David, and this was the pinnacle of Israel's history. A beautiful dynasty where there was plenty of everything. There was victory in the battlefields, and his lands grew. But at that time, God gave Israel a promise that there would become a lineage from the King of David that would have a kingdom that would never end. And Israel at that point took hold of that promise, as they well should have. But as they marched into their own future 300 years later, had already been lots of competition, lots of fighting for the throne, and now one unified kingdom had separated into two. So we had the northern kingdom of Judah and the southern kingdom of Israel. And Israel had forgotten, the whole people of Israel had forgotten what Moses said about how to treat one another and how to relate to Yahweh, and had instead had taken the promise given to David about an eternal dynasty and said, we are entitled. We are the chosen people. God will be our protector no matter what. Excuse me. And so that's where Israel was, in a position of entitlement. And how this worked its way out was that they would go to church, they would go to the temple, to the synagogue on Sunday, go about the ritual routine, and that's what it was only routine. And they would leave that service, they would leave their worship, and immediately go to cheat their neighbor. The neighboring pagan religions began to seep their way in to the Jewish holidays, the Jewish practices, and so that they were very synchronistic. That's a tough word. The wealthy would go and make their wealth by falsifying weights and measures in the marketplace. And the poor would try to go to the courts for fairness, but the courts were corrupt. And into this kind of sick culture that Israel had become, they'd lost their way in how to treat one another and how to worship Yahweh. The prophets would speak. And they would speak two basic messages: that God was going to bring judgment upon that culture, upon the nation of Israel, and that that would come in the form of Babylon, who would come and invade those two kingdoms. But the other message was the message that Matthew shares with us, and that is that even in the midst of this darkness, that there would be light. That there was a kingdom and a restoration that God was about, and he would bring this into place. So Matthew picks up this theme, and he says this theme is being met in Jesus Christ, that it's Jesus Christ who is the Davidic, that he is the one who carries the throne. He is the king who will have the new kingdom that will last forever. And Matthew makes that link for us with Jesus. But back to Israel, first in the time of judgment, that northern kingdom fell first because Babylon was coming in from the north. It fell first, and they subjugated all the people there. They destroyed all their crops and lands. And then within 100 years, the southern kingdom fell as well. The temple was destroyed. There was loss of life. Disease settled in. They deported all their cream of the crop leadership so that Israel, the southern kingdom, was in a time of darkness. Where was Yahweh? Weren't they the entitled people? Wasn't God going to set up a kingdom through us? How is it that our lives are falling apart? How is it that they're being destroyed? They were in a faith crisis. They didn't know what it meant to be God's chosen people. They thought they understood, but they didn't. So God keeps speaking hope as well as judgment into their lives. When Jerusalem was falling, the prophet Jeremiah, was in jail because he had delivered a message that the king was not very happy about. So instead of embracing the message from God, the king threw Jeremiah in jail. After a time, he got out, and God gave him something to do. And this is the word that he gave Jeremiah at that time. These are Jeremiah's words in the first person. At that time, the Lord sent me, Jeremiah, a message. And he said, buy the field at Anathoth. So I bought the field at Anathoth, paying 17 pieces of silver for it. I signed and sealed the deed of purchase before witnesses, weighed out the silver, and paid. And then I took the sealed deed and the unsealed copy of the deed, and I handed it to Baruch. Then I said to Baruch, as they all listened, this is what the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of Israel, says. Take both this sealed deed and the unsealed copy and put them into a pottery jar to preserve them for a long time. For this is what the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of Israel, says. Someday people will again own property here in this land and will buy and sell houses and vineyards and fields. I will restore prosperity to them. I, the Lord, have spoken. So when we put this in context, God has given Jeremiah something to do. Something that is radical, that it makes no sense, it's surprising, it's counterintuitive, it's forward-looking. He says, go and buy a field, exactly the ones that are being burned down and destroyed. And even though we're going to take you and all of your fellow leaders into another country for 70 years, I want you to take that jar with you, with the deed in it. I want you to own that and invest in that, because it's a beacon of hope that you will return to this land. Take it as a symbol in the middle of your captivity that there is more coming, that there is goodness coming, that all is not as it seems, that there is another reality. And that's really what hope is. It's confidence in things not yet seen. And that is how I want us to learn to move through this season. We live in darkness. It's just covered by all the tinsel and all the flashing lights, which I love. I love all that stuff. I love coming up our street and wondering who's put lights out. And it's never us because we don't do it. But I love everybody else to do it so I can enjoy it. But we're assaulted, aren't we? Not by physical armies, but we're assaulted by our fear of the future, by what's going to happen, by situations in which we don't see a way out, by broken relationships that we live among. We're assaulted by that, especially in this season. We're assaulted by Christmas frenzy and a mad dash to fill holes in our lives. We're assaulted by the challenge to look happy all the time, and not only that, to be creative while you're doing it. That's way too much for some of us. And in the midst of all this assault, God's voice wants to ring into our hearts and into our lives. He wants to say to us, just like he did to Jeremiah, go and buy a field. Go and do something that's counterintuitive. Go and do something that's surprising, that doesn't make any sense in the light of your culture and what's going on around it. Go invest, he is saying, in something that I am doing, I, God, am doing. I am ushering in a new kingdom. I'm restoring walls that have been broken down. Do something counterintuitive. Invest instead of run. Do something surprising, because there's more here than the culture knows. Do something about God's restoration. And I believe that in doing this, we have to learn how to rethink. Because if we can find the mindset that this offers us, if we can wrap our minds around what God is talking about this hope, then the opportunities and what we are to do will take care of itself. I don't know how many of you have heard Henry Van Dyke. I kind of heard the name, but I ran across something which kind of encapsulated what I think God would have our mindset to be. All of this is counterintuitive. He says, are you willing to forget what you have done for other people and to remember what other people have done for you? To ignore what the world owes you and to think what you owe the world? To put your rights in the background and your duties in the middle ground and your chances to do a little bit more than your duty in the foreground? Are you willing to see that men and women are just as real as you are and try to look behind their faces to their hearts hungry for joy? To close your book of complaints against the management of the universe and look around you for a place where you can sow a few seeds of happiness. Are you willing to do these even for a day, he says? Are you willing to stoop down and consider the needs and desires of little children? To stop asking how much your friends love you and ask yourself whether you love them enough? Are you willing to trim your lamp so that it will give more light and less smoke? Are you willing to make a grave for your ugly thoughts and a garden for your kindly feelings with the gate open? Are you willing to do these even for a day? Then you can keep Christmas. And there's more. And what I'm going to ask Anna Fish to do for us is put this in the next e-bulletin so you can take it home with you. So that you can reflect. Pick one a day and take it home. If we can change the way we think, we will know how to invest in the kingdom on a daily basis. Our own darkness would lift because we would be living lives that are about other people and about God. We would see the opportunities, as I said. They would translate into powerful acts of kindness and forgiveness and selflessness. We would be casting a vision towards what God is about. We would be buying a field. When all of culture is going this way, we will learn to go that way by learning not to think of ourselves. And I want to say that these are the symbols of hope in this season. Yes, it is the candle. Yes, it is the bells. Yes, it is the memory that we have of certain events. But it's so much more. And God calls us to go and be those beacons of light, be that symbol in the way of darkness. Be the light. And I have a feeling that this is the kind of Christmas that C.S. Lewis would really embrace. This is what his life was about. And I forgot to mention that that was written in 1957. I wonder what he'd say today if he could see us. Pretty wild. This table is set for us as a table of hope, and it is forward-looking. It looks forward to the time when Jesus himself will serve us around the table, around the kingdom that has been restored. When we are all whole and he has come again and he has purged us and cleansed us from all that is dark and murky and shadowy and yucky. And we stand flawless and clean and pure before him. It stands as a hope for us in this darkness. If you're thinking, there's no way I can be that beacon where I'm going, you have no idea where I'm going and how dark it is, I'm saying, then take the light of this table and go and take it. Come and take of Jesus Christ and let his light shine through your life. Let it make a difference. As we go before the Lord, I'd like to invite the elders and the deacons to come forward. Those of you who are here to serve communion, to please come forward. Lord, thank you for this table. Thank you that you lit a light in the darkness for Israel back in the 600 BC. Thank you that in the coming of Christ that you came as a person that would light our darkness for eternity. And that we have that light within us. And that when it seems to be distinguishing, where it tends to get weak and flicker, that you are there to trim it, to give us more oil for our light, our lamp. And that you send us into the darkness as symbols of hope ourselves. So thank you for that. Thank you for this table that does all these things. Thank you for the cross. Thank you for the hope that we have. And I pray all these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.